From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. And this morning, we speak with award-winning winemaker out of Sonoma County, Lisa Bishop Forbes, about the science of winemaking, from sulfites to malolactic fermentation. Learn about the chemistry behind turning grapes into wine.
And then we speak with local resident and tech entrepreneur Stephen Bowl. He's the CEO of Mattia Mobility. It's a company based in Salt Lake City that's dedicated to the creation of innovative robotic mobility devices, specifically helping those who typically are in wheelchairs. Stay tuned. We'll be back after these words. You're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg.
Most of us who enjoy a glass of wine have a romantic notion of how it's made. Pick some grapes, stomp on them like in the movies, toss them in a barrel, and let time work its magic. And while humans have been perfecting this delicious elixir for over 8,000 years, the real story of winemaking is far more complex and far more scientific.
But here on Cool Science Radio, we love exploring the science behind the everyday things we often take for granted. Today, we're thrilled to welcome an award-winning winemaker from Sonoma County, California, who will take us beyond the grape-stomping cliches and into the fascinating, complex science of how great wine is truly made.
Lisa Bishop Forbes began her career as an enologist, a wine chemist at the renowned Joseph Phelps Vineyards. Over the past four decades, she has crafted wines at Chalk Hill, Dry Creek, and Ectimo, now serves as a consulting winemaker, and most recently launched her own label, Bishop Forbes Wine. It's a fascinating world in which science meets art, and we're excited to dive into it. Lisa, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
So happy to be here and talk with you guys.
Okay, let's start with this. I mean, that was a very simplified version of what I think most of us know about how wine is made. But maybe you could just start with a very simple overview of how it's done.
Sure. It really all starts in the vineyard and choosing good grapes, because you can't make good wine out of not so good grapes. So you start there, you have your own winery or a winery for hire that does the work for you, which is what I do. Based on whether it's white or red or rosé even, the process varies, but essentially you're processing grapes, mainly taking the grapes off the stems and either pressing those grapes to get the juice out to make white wine or rosé, or fermenting with the skins for red wine. That's where all the color and the flavor comes from. And from there, you can add yeast, like if you're baking bread, you add a little yeast, or like making sourdough, you can just go with whatever is in your atmosphere. That's called a native yeast or resident yeast. You let that do their thing, and within a week or two, usually, you have finished wine. All the sugars changed into alcohol. And then you put it in a tank or barrels, depending on the wine you're making. And after it's aged and it's, you know, done what you want it to do, it tastes great and it's the style that you want, then you put it in the bottle.
And away you go.
Away you go.
So is it the enologist's job then? Let's go back to the vine and the grape. I'm picturing you going out into the vineyard with your little needle and extracting some juice from a grape and then testing it and seeing if it's ready. Am I just completely off there?
Nope, you're pretty close. So usually I either, depending on the vineyard, will take my bucket and my clippers and I'll collect bunches of grapes. Or you can collect little individual grape berries and put those in a zip top bag. And you want to have a representative sample of the vineyard. So you squish up the grapes, pour off the juice, and then measure that. So you can measure the sugar and the acidity. And for every grape I put in a bag, I taste one. So that's critical too, to kind of match the numbers, the chemistry of the juice with what you're tasting. And that Ultimately, I will choose to pick grapes based on the taste.
Very cool. I'm going to actually go back to something. I just went to your website and I love the very first thing that pops up, Lisa. It says art and science intertwined. And I think so many people miss the science part. They think you just throw grapes in a bathtub and voila, you get something interesting or not, maybe not that interesting. But
Not so interesting.
not so interesting. So many people don't understand really the science behind it. You were just talking about, measuring the sugar, what we refer to as BRICS. A lot of people don't even know about these scientific terms that are used. And in winemaking, there's so much that goes into the science of it. First of all, you've got to keep everything super clean. People don't understand that. They think, again, just throwing it into a vat and voila. And then, the whole science of, well, when do I pick and do I destem or do I throw the whole cluster in? And that's a decision they make. But the one thing I'd like you to touch on again, you mentioned it, a lot of people think that red wine comes from red grapes and that, you squeeze the grape and red juice comes out. Can you maybe just talk a little bit about the difference between what makes a red wine and a white wine?
Sure. There are obvious differences in the grapes just by looking at them. But white wine grapes are typically kind of a gold yellow green color, and the juice in the pulp is colorless. With red grapes like Pinot Noir, Cabernet Sauvignon, they have dark purpley red skins, but the pulp and juice is also clear. So when you are making red wine, you want to basically kind of lightly crush those grapes, break them open, and by putting the skins in constant contact with the juice, that process of soaking and mixing up, we call it a pump over or a punch down, keeping those skins submerged in the juice. That's how you extract the color and the flavor. Also, the tannin, that gives you the structure of the wine. All of that starts to come out once those grapes are broken open. And then for rosé, which is sort of in the middle, it's not mixing white wine and red wine together, although some people may think so.
Oh.
It's, I know. It's typically you, and again, it depends on the style you're trying to make. You break open the grapes, we call it, crushing, lightly. And then what the winemaker does is, continually look at the juice and taste. And when the color is what they want and the flavor is where they want it to be, then those grapes will all get pressed off, and you get the pink colored juice out. So it's a, maybe a day or two of that, whereas making a red wine might take 2 weeks, where you're getting all that color and flavor out.
Is there a technical term for that color in the skins that departs the color to the juice?
It's, well, you could call it a maceration. Basically, when you're mixing a solid something with a liquid something, in order to extract whatever it might be from that, there's what's called a délestage, which is basically midway through fermentation, draining the juice off of red grapes and then pumping it back in over the top. That helps really kind of sort of kick into high gear that extraction. The punch down is typically if you're in a small vessel, if you're doing a lot of whole clusters in there, which you had mentioned before, certain varieties like Pinot Noir, maybe Syrah will lend themselves to having actually whole bunches of grapes mixed in with the crushed up grapes, get a different flavor profile that way. And then a pump over is where you're actually taking the juice or the wine from the bottom of the tank through a pump and then sprinkling it back over the top. So it's just different ways of extracting those colors and flavors and keeping the skins, which will float up to the top. You want to keep them wet.
Okay. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with award-winning winemaker Lisa Bishop Forbes. Her new-ish label is Bishop Forbes Wine. And we're talking to her today about the science behind winemaking, because why not? Why not? Lisa, I'm wondering if you could explain this interplay between the sugars and the alcohol. And I don't know how to expand on that question other than just, I know that if you go high on the one, you get less of the other, maybe.
Sort of, yes. So grapes have sugar in them, like any fruit does. And the riper the fruit gets, the higher the sugar gets. So for means of comparison, table grapes will be maybe 15, 16% sugar. Wine grapes are typically more like 22 to 24, 25% sugar. And that percentage is what Scott had mentioned is called Brix. It's a weight by weight percentage. So during the fermentation process, the yeast will convert the sugar to alcohol and carbon dioxide. So you get fizzy at the same time you get your alcohol. And so obviously the higher your sugar level in the fruit, the higher your alcohol will be. So there you figure it's about a 60% conversion between your sugar and your percentage of alcohol in the finished wine.
Okay, so you mentioned carbon dioxide as well. And we were talking earlier in the green room about an effervescent wine like Vinho Verde that is served in Portugal. Does this have anything to do with the carbon dioxide? Is that it is effervescent, so it's slightly bubbly, not even nearly like a Prosecco or a champagne or anything, but it's also lower in alcohol. And we were talking about how people, normally if they're having wine with lunch or something, they want it to be lower alcohol, hopefully. Otherwise, it's known as day drinking. could you comment on that?
Sure. So something like that, where there's a wine with a slight fizz to it, typically those are white wines or maybe even a rosé that's bottled really early in its life. So maybe within a few months of the harvest. So just by, the nature of fermentation, some of that bit of fizz will stay in the wine because it hasn't had time to go away. So, and then the lower alcohol part of that, it really has to do with when the grapes are picked. So a fresh, fruity white wine with real bright acidity would typically be picked at a lower sugar. So you have lower sugar, lower alcohol, and you retain a little of that fizz. That's what gives the wine its liveliness.
Like a Vino Verde, for example.
Yes, exactly.
So Lisa, one of the big debates that people have about, oh, that wine gives me a headache, or the culprit is always sulfites. That's the number one thing they say. And I always have this conversation with people like, there's sulfites in everything, right? If you have an apricot, a dried apricot, there's probably more sulfites in one dried apricot than a bottle of wine. I would love your opinion about sulfites and why they're so important in the winemaking process.
Sure. Sulfites, or sulfur dioxide, they provide a really important role in generally preserving the wine, preventing any, nasty bacteria or spoilage organism that could show up. It prevents that from taking hold of your wine. It's also an antioxidant, which, when you cut into an apple and it turns brown, that's an oxidation. The same thing can happen in grapes or wine, and those sulfites will help prevent that oxidation from happening. Now, yeast will also produce sulfites. So if someone's really sensitive to it, your best option is an organic wine, not just organic grapes, but organic wine, which doesn't allow adding extra sulfites. So those wines, the winemaker pays just incredibly close attention to that because one of, that critical tool isn't available to them. So I think for most winemakers, especially, winemakers that are doing really super high quality wine, the idea is to do as little as possible. You add just enough to do the job, but not too much. So that's how I approach it, certainly. So there isn't right now a really great alternative to sulfites. So it's managing your wine, making sure your acidity is at a good level, making sure your grapes are clean, your winery's clean. All of those things will allow you to add less So I think as far as people's headaches go, there are histamines in wine, which in red wine in particular.
Right.
So that could also cause some issues for people who are sensitive to that. But yeah, I the culprit's always sulfites. But as you said, if your dried apricot is orange, it's probably loaded and with way more than would be in a bottle of wine.
It is interesting that the Australians are toying around with a sulfite substitute made from green tea leaves. And it's just been the last, I'm going to say, 18 months that I've seen research on this. So, stay tuned. It might be kind of an interesting thing that comes along. Those Aussies.
They are great. The Australian Wine Research Institute is, they're on the forefront of all of that. So that's good to know. I'm going to look that up.
Great. Well, along the same lines as, the culprit giving me a headache, we know because we live in Park City at high altitude, our town is at 7,000, some of us live higher, that a lot of it is wrapped up with altitude and that headache and everything. But the other thing I've been hearing people say, and I think it's because when they go to Europe and they're drinking wine in Italy and France, everything is so wonderful and the wine is so much better and it's, on and on and on and it doesn't give me a headache. They also say, oh, it's because when it's shipped across the Atlantic, it changes fundamentally. So I wanted you to, either be the myth buster on that science or talk about what can happen to a wine when it's transported.
Yeah, it's and then we had talked about that earlier, and the whole idea of shipping a wine somewhere, even if it's from one end of California to the other, it's a big state, but I think moving something will change it. And that process of putting a wine in a container on a ship going across the Atlantic, it's hard on the wine. And how it chemically changes, I really don't know, but I don't buy that it would change that much going, from Italy, to New York, or then and then over to California or something like that. The whole process of like jostling wine around, temperature changes, all of that will have an effect on the quality of the wine, but I don't know about the specific chemistry of it. I think, if you're having a great time, you're on holiday and you're drinking wine, a lot of the European wines are they are lower alcohol too. That could be part of it. I think it's the whole thing. You're caught up in the social aspect of it. You're probably eating when you're drinking your wine, and it's just all very festive and fun, and you don't think about it so much maybe as when you're at home.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, let's go into something that I know very little about, but I will say that I have tried your Bishop Forbes Chardonnay, which is so delicious. And I'm not a lover of Chardonnay because I don't like that vanilla, oaky thing. I will say your Chardonnay reminds me not of a Chardonnay, and I think that's why I love it so much. What's that all about?
Well, I've made, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of cases of Chardonnay over the years at wineries that I've worked at. And I almost never drink it because I didn't, as you said, care for the buttery, oaky, super rich style, which was the hallmark of the wineries that I worked for. And that's a totally valid thing. But when I had the opportunity to make my own wine, I somehow chose Chardonnay, I think to prove that I could make something that I would want to drink. So I focused initially on the vineyard and chose a vineyard that's about 10 miles from the Pacific Ocean as the crow flies, or Western Sonoma County. It's very cool, and the fruit retains its acidity. So I do use some oak. I don't stainless ferment for my wine, but I don't choose to have that buttery flavor as part of the profile. So I wanted fresh fruit. I wanted nice, firm acidity, which helps the wine age too. And I just really wanted to showcase the fruit. The oak is a supporting player. It's there, but it's not the dominant flavor. I wanted to show off that fruit. So that was my purpose for choosing that.
Lisa, what I'm curious because a lot of times, at least my experience has been, you get that kind of that buttery thing going on through the malolactic fermentation, and it occurs also in red wine. I would love, and it's a mystery to me. Every time I think I understand malolactic fermentation, I have it wrong. Could you just spend a couple minutes telling our audience about malolactic fermentation and what it does to the wine and why you would use it or not use it?
Sure. So the malolactic fermentation, or it's called sometimes a secondary fermentation, happens after the primary fermentation, which is the alcohol being formed from the sugar. So it's a process by which malic acid, which is one of the main acids in grapes, and it's also what's in apples, is converted by a specific type of bacteria into lactic acid, which you find in milk or butter, things like that. So it's a softer acid. So if you're making a white wine and you want a little bit of, creaminess, maybe the acid's a little high, you want to drop that, or it's just really a stylistic consideration. Or you're making red wine, that's very typical for that process to happen. And you can either, let it happen naturally, or you can add a specific culture bacteria to do that. For red wines, most red wines are not filtered. So you want the wine to be microbially stable so that you don't have to filter. So that process in red wines is really for stability. In white wines, it's more a style consideration because typically most white wines are filtered because you want them to look nice and sparkly clean. So that malolactic fermentation then, depending on the bacteria that you choose, and there are several companies that specialize in yeast and bacteria for the wine industry, you can, promote the butteriness, which is a byproduct of that, if that's the style that you're looking for, or not. So I choose a bacteria culture, or I let it go naturally, that does not produce the buttery compound, which is called diacetyl. And that's reminiscent of like movie theater popcorn. That's it. And some people love that. And this is not to pass any judgment on anything that people enjoy or like. There's something for everyone out there. For me, I don't care for the buttery. So, but I do want to add some creaminess. So, like, think of the taste of heavy cream versus the taste of buttered popcorn.
Oh,
So,
diacetyl, I love. See, this is why we call it cool science radio.
yes, it is cool science radio for sure. For sure. So, does that answer your question in enough detail?
Absolutely. And I appreciate it because I'm always confused about when a winemaker chooses to use malolactic fermentation. I get it for the red wines, for the stabilization, but I guess it really is just more of a stylistic choice, particularly in Chardonnay.
It is. Chardonnay is the most common white wine that will go through that process. And there are, areas where it's warmer, where if you put your Chardonnay through malolactic, your acid might be too low. And then the wine seems kind of flabby. And nobody likes that.
So you briefly mentioned, Lisa, filtration, and you said that filtration is almost like a stylistic choice. And as you were talking, it made me think of these hazy IPA beers, like it's the hazier, like the better, but filtration seems like it's a little bit different with wine. What is filtration about other than keeping it clear, and how much does it lend itself to a flavor or a style?
Yeah, that's a great question. Typically, the bigger the winery, the more likely they will filter everything. And that's kind of a broad generalization, but I'm of the viewpoint that filtration is a tool. It's not good or bad. Some people make it out to be a bad thing, like you're gonna remove something good from your wine. But if it's needed, it's a good tool to have. So going back to that malolactic fermentation and the stability question, most red wines, they're dark colored. You can't tell if they're a tiny bit hazy or cloudy, and most of them aren't. If you do a good job in the winery, Anything hazy will have settled to the bottom of the barrel and it won't be in your finished wine. You still have, the choice is yours to filter or not. With white wines, if you have a Chardonnay that's gone through a full malolactic, that wine is considered stable as well. So if it's clear visually to your satisfaction and you don't want to filter, you don't have to. With other white wines, they're chance of something happening in the bottle is there if you don't filter. So basically that it's physically removing any yeast or bacteria that might still be left in the wine, just so that you don't have anything bad happen after the wine's bottled. So again, stylistic considerations, yes. Some people choose not to filter. They, kind of take their chances even with a white wine. There are winemakers that don't want to do anything, and that's their style, their prerogative. You just have to be really careful through the whole process to make sure your wine is nice and clean, physically clean and microbially clean, so that you don't have to filter.
Okay, I have one final challenging perhaps question. The alcohol-free movement is really, really gaining steam, and I mentioned beer before, and I'm thinking specifically they're starting to make some really good beers that are alcohol-free. Because it's part of the whole process of winemaking, how would that ever be accomplished in any meaningful way? And is the whole wine industry, looking at that because it is a growing movement?
It is definitely a growing movement. I'll put the caveat out there that I have never made de-alcoholized wine, but the process has been around since I think the 80s probably. It was really kind of in its infancy when I was in college. And so there are companies that will remove alcohol from wine. The issue I see is that alcohol gives the wine a lot of its body and weight, kind of the mouthfeel of it. So if you take that away, you're left with kind of a thin, watery something. And often, or the thing which makes up that loss of alcohol is sugar. So you're kind of trading one evil for another, if you want to look at it that way. I get the wanting to have lower alcohol, and maybe that's a compromise in there where it's just a lower alcohol wine, maybe 10% or 8%, something like that, where you still have some of that mouthfeel and weight, but not the sugar. I think there are a lot of improving technologies with beer. You're starting with lower alcohol in the first place, so maybe you're not taking as much away. But I think it's very valid. I mean, there are non-alcohol spirits. There's a real push for it, and I think it's important because people want alternatives, and it's definitely it's a worthy pursuit.
Yeah. Our guest has been Lisa Bishop Forbes. She is the founder of Bishop Forbes Wines, and she's joining us today on Cool Science Radio to speak about the science of winemaking. What a fun topic. Lisa, how do people find your wines?
I do have a website, bishopforbeswines.com.
Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio today. It's been quite illuminating. Lots of things I didn't know. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on your show. It's been fun.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. Our next guest, Stephen Bowl, is a local Park City resident and CEO and chairman of the board of directors of Mattia Mobility, a Salt Lake City-based manufacturer of robotic standing wheelchairs.
After debuting the first product in 2015, Mattia Mobility has continued to innovate toward their ultimate goal, improving the health, wellness, and sense of independence for as many people as possible. Stephen Bowl joins us in the studio to discuss leading a team of expert inventors and engineers who are dedicated to creating these innovative robotic mobility devices for those with walking disabilities, as well as the life-changing impact that such products can have. Stephen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Lynn, Scott, thank you both for having me here.
This is so exciting. And all you need to do is go on Mattia Mobility website to really get a sense of, you've got great videos of folks who have been seated in a wheelchair for, you know, many decades, some of them, to now going to be supported in this standing mobility device. It's really phenomenal. How did you get involved?
You know, it's actually a very interesting human interest story, how this all began. It was about 13 or 14 years ago. We saw a video online, right? I'll get back to we in a minute. We saw a video online on a tech blog, and it was a handmade device. It looked like somebody had made it in their basement. And it was fascinating. It was for paraplegics, and it turned out there were a couple of inventors in a university lab in Turkey, in Istanbul, who had made it for a friend of theirs. So I emailed the company. I was able to find the address. When I say company, it was a loose band of inventors. And it had gone quite viral. Now, placed back 13, 14 years ago, viral means they got 1,000 emails. It doesn't mean 30 million TikTok views. Mm-hmm. Turns out that they were preparing for their first trade show, and they were overwhelmed with the response they got, but they only responded to one. At the time, I was running a company called coupons.com that I had started in 1998, and it turned out the inventor's sister had gone to Pepperdine in California and had heard of it. But it was a thanks but no thanks note. It was, "Dear Mr. Bull, thank you so much for your kind note. We'll be at a prosthetic device trade show in Leipzig, Germany in 2 weeks. Feel free to meet us there. Sincerely, Aisha Hirokoglu." I've had 13 years to practice that last name. I called my late business partner, passed away 2 years ago. He was in Sydney, Australia. And I said, "Paul, it's right up our alley. It's hardware, it's software, it's regulatory, it's cross-border, it's medical device. We've never done anything like it, but look at the life-changing opportunity there is here." We flew to Berlin, we took a train to Leipzig, and we met them. And while we were there, a woman rolled up in a wheelchair with a translator, East German, former East German, and wanted to try it. And I said, "Great, this is market research for me." She got in the device, she rode around for a half an hour, she came back and she sat down. And through the translator, I said, "What did you think?" And she loved it. And I said, "Would you buy one of these?" She said, "How much?" And I said, "I have no idea. It's not even a product. $50,000 US. I made a number up. She said, "Oh no." I said, "25. Oh no. 10. Oh no. 5. Oh no. $1,000 US. Oh no." I'm thinking, there goes the market research.
Right.
I turned to the founders and I said, "Look, we don't know each other very well, but what I'd like to do for this woman is, if this is ever a real product, I would like to buy her one myself, the first one that we ever make, or you ever make, if we never see you again." And they agreed. And we told her through the translator, and she got very angry. She thought we were making fun of her for not being able to afford it. But we cleared it up. She spent all her money that month for a ticket just to try it, to come into the show. The wow. First product that came off the line, I took out a checkbook and I wrote a check for $11,000, and she got it. And she got serial number one and got 2.5 years out of it. She passed away, but she had 2.5 years of standing mobility as a result.
Wow. You know, if you've ever been at an event, and I was at a wedding recently where one of the guests of the wedding was in a wheelchair. And, at a wedding, people are dancing and talking and everyone's standing. And, I'm sure there are many events that we could list where most people are standing and then the person in the wheelchair is at a different level. And at this wedding, I said, "Well, I'm going to go and dance with our friend who's in a wheelchair." And, it still makes it hard. It still makes it hard. And when I saw your product, I thought, why didn't this? I mean, this just seems like a no-brainer. I guess I'm curious, have you met with any resistance from those people who have been in a wheelchair, who have been seated for a long time? Is there ever any reason that they say, "No, I don't want to stand"? Can't imagine it.
No, never. Absolutely right. The critical thing to remember here is that when you're in a wheelchair, you're looking up at people. What we constantly hear is, "I don't want to look in people's nostrils anymore. I don't want to feel like I'm being spoken down to anymore." And when you go to events, like you just said, and there are more than one person who's confined to a wheelchair, they're typically together because they're at the same level. This device allows you to get up on your own. And so you're paraplegic, you're in bed. You don't need an aide to come over and get you out of bed anymore. It has a remote control. You call it over. You put your legs into it in a sling behind you, and it stands you up on its own. And then you can move in your home. You don't even need ADA you know, spaces. You don't need to widen your aisles and lower your cabinets and change your electricity and your plumbing, because this fits in very small spaces. So people who are in wheelchairs for a year, 5 years, we just had a woman who's been in a wheelchair for 42 years. She hasn't stood on her own for 42 years, and 2 weeks ago she stood on her own. So it's really quite remarkable. The only resistance we get is price and insurance companies. And as we all know, it's difficult in today's world to have an insurance company pay for things that are truly life-enabling for people because they're managing their bottom lines.
Stephen, this is just, it's life-changing. It's remarkable. And I want to back up a little bit about your history. And you've talked about, you know, sending this email to this company in Turkey and your interchange with them, but you've taken a very circuitous route to becoming the CEO now of this company. Can you just kind of maybe take a couple minutes and take us through your history and how you actually ended up? I mean, it's one thing to send an email saying, hey, I'm interested in then meeting them in Germany, and now you're actually running the company. I mean, how did all of that happen?
They were amenable to us giving them advice and advising them on growing the business. My business partner at the time, Paul, again, who passed away, he lived in Sydney. He and I put a little bit of money into the business and then started to give them a lot of advice and professionalizing what they were doing. I stepped away from my role. I was running a public company at the time. I left, stayed on the board, and stepped in to run this business, which to me is a passion project that I could see myself doing for the rest of my life. And then I had to go back to my public company to help it do a turnaround. And so we had somebody else step in to run this business for a few years. Once we were done with the public company, I came back to run it full time. So I've been in and out of this business for about 13 years, but always very tightly wrapped around it. And obviously have had a lot of influence over the move from Turkey to the United States, the move to Salt Lake City, and the go-to-market strategy. The original founders, Ines Kadmer and Najati Hirokoglu, are still intimately involved in the business and leadership. We're a very tight group. It's like a family. And we're all on the board together. And we're just as passionate and involved today as we were 13 years ago, the day we met.
Wow. Okay. So I guess the other question is, why Salt Lake City?
That's a great question. I actually moved the headquarters of my public company to Salt Lake City as well. When I was leading that, we were down in Sugar House. I think Utah is the best state in this country to do business in. There are a variety of reasons for that. But the labor pool, the talent pool, the environment, let's not forget about the weather. it's central. The Salt Lake City airport never shuts down. Our factory is about 7 minutes from the Salt Lake City airport. We ship a very heavy device on crate, and so we have rail, we've got trucking, and we've got air, and we can get devices anywhere in the world from Salt Lake City. So we manufacture here and ship all over the world. If I was starting another company today, there's no place I would do it other than here.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Stephen Bowl. He is a local resident. He's also the CEO and chairman of the board of directors of Mattia Mobility. It's a Salt Lake City-based manufacturer of robotic standing wheelchairs. Okay, I have to get into the physiology of, you know, we've been told, what, that sitting is the new smoking. And I have a fair idea of why that is. You know, you sit on an airplane for 10 hours and lots of things start to go wrong with your body. So for those who are, and I hate to say that word, confined to a wheelchair, because no doubt there's a better way to say it, and actually they are no longer confined to a wheelchair because there is the Mattia Mobility device, which is the main device is called the
Tech RMD,
that's right. So it's got to be better for circulation and digestion and all of that. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Well, it's better for circulation, it's better for digestion, but there are lots of things that happen when you are disabled or paralyzed or you have a walking disability that impacts your ability to get up and move around. So it's not just circulation and digestion. Think about bone density. Gravity's pull on your bones is something that helps you counteract the loss of bone density as you age. So standing actually helps you maintain bone density. sores, pressure sores. Mm. This is a very serious issue for people who are in wheelchair. And so particularly if you have paralysis and you can't feel parts of your body, lower half of your body, depending on where your injury might be, and a lot of this is spinal cord injury, so you really have, you're fully paralyzed from a certain level down, pressure sore is a very serious thing because it opens up, it becomes infected. And one of the biggest troubles that people have who are in wheelchairs is the issue of pressure sores. Standing alleviates that as well. In addition, we all know now, 10 years ago, nobody was talking about this. Mental health and physical health are so tightly intertwined. Mental health is so critically important to be focused on as a real thing, right? Not, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, people weren't talking about this. Now it's all we talk about. The mental health aspect of being independent, autonomous, totally on your own, eye level, interacting with people, being able to go to work. So we have an operating room doctor in the New York area, Dr. Ian Brown. He's allowed us to use his name. He was in the military. He was injured in the line of fire. When he was paralyzed, he invented a small wheelchair. That was his passion for people. And then he went and got his medical degree. And it's an amazing story. He is able to be in the operating room working as a doctor in our tech RMD. The hospital he works in set up a lab. They checked for sterilization. He was able to go up and down and get to drawers and things like that. He intubates. Everything's an anesthesiologist. It's incredible. We have two surgical residents who are paralyzed who are using the tech RMD so they can finish school and become surgeons. The first person in the U.S. to ever get one was a fellow by the name of Bill Winchester. He's a good friend of mine. We talk all the time. He was the fire captain in Reno, Nevada. He was injured in a bike race. And he was able to walk across the field with his daughter at graduation in his tech RMD, still using it today. He was the first person in the U.S. to get one. And there are just so many stories. We just had a young man who graduated, and he wanted to graduate in his tech RMD, and we worked with him and his mom and the insurance company to be able to get him his tech RMD so that he could have it around the time of graduation. We also have people who've been married in them. And in fact, we loaned one to somebody so they could get married many years ago, just to your point about being at a wedding.
That's beautiful. Quick question that I'm thinking of. My friend who had a spinal cord injury, it's pretty high in the thoracic spine. What level of what level of spinal cord injury can you have to be able to still use it? Do you have to have mobility above a certain area of the spine?
So we actually will adjust the chest plate and the strapping depending on where your level of injury is. And so these are actually custom built. So we have standard product, and then we build it for you based on a series of measurements, five measurements, that height, weight, and then measurements like from your heel to your xiphoid process and things like that. And so if you have to have some trunk support, but the higher it is, the higher we move the chest plate for you. You do have to have some dexterity in your hands to be able to use the device. We have a fellow in New York who's a stroke victim who has very little mobility of one of his arms, and he is using the device. And so we really can adapt it for the patient. A full quadriplegic cannot use it. But partial quad, paraplegic, MS, cerebral palsy, depending on sort of the level of the cerebral palsy that you have, ALS, obviously spinal cord injury, spina bifida, these are all conditions where we can adjust the device mostly for you, stroke, et cetera.
By the way, if you're listening and we're talking about the mobility device and how to control, go to the website and check out some of these photos. It's incredible. It's Mattia Mobility. Definitely check it out. Stephen, not only are you a Park City resident, but you give back to the community here in Park City. And you and I have a shared passion with the National Mobility Center. So first of all, thank you very much for your support.
I would say thank you for having it here. I mean, that is one of the most outstanding facilities I've ever.
It is.
An outdoor ropes course for disabled. I mean, come on, that does not exist at the level that it does here. And we're thrilled it's here in Park City, and we're thrilled to be able to help.
Well, we share that mutual passion. I would love to get maybe just a couple minutes of your involvement with the National Mobility Center and what you've seen and Are there people there that are using the mobility device?
I wouldn't know if there are people there using it specifically. I've been to the site many, many times, and I spoke with the prior CEO about getting more involved in the National Ability Center personally, at a personal level, not on a professional level.
That's great, because I think that it's just a great organization. I think it's a natural match, too, for your device and people here in the Park City community and throughout the world. I think you're in 23 countries. Did I see that?
Yeah, probably more, but we know of 23. The thing about what we do is everybody in our business has a personal reason for being there. Our site director, U.S. site director and head of compliance, his mom was in a wheelchair with MS for decades. Our head of sales wife is in the business. My brother, sadly, is living with ALS right now. We all really have an attachment to this business. Every device that goes out is not a number. We have a name associated with it. It's really about helping people live their lives, you know, in as best a way as possible.
A bit ago, you talked about this disconnect between insurance companies and the ability to have the device covered, but you have some happy news with, isn't it Blue Cross Blue Shield?
We do have some happy news. And I want to say this is another example of doing business in the state of Utah. So we are now in network with Blue Cross Blue Shield. We did it with Regents here in Utah, and that gave us access to 95% of the country's Blue Cross Blue Shield. And it's made a world of difference for our patients, just a world of difference. But the truth of the matter is, if you can't write a check for the device, we have financing available. We have a great financing partner that can keep people's payments under $500 a month. And so it becomes affordable. But in reality, people depend on their insurance companies. They pay their premiums their whole lives, and then they face the juggernaut, the obstacle of trying to get it paid for. And we have an insurance team that does this, and that team works with an outside party. It is really a full court press on behalf of our patients, and it can take 6 weeks to, believe it or not, 6 months to get even an answer out of an insurance company before we even find out if it'll be covered.
Hmm. Wow. I don't know how much wheelchairs cost. What's the price differential between the tech RMD and a wheelchair if you're paying out of pocket?
So you can't compare it to a standard wheelchair, to a manual wheelchair, mm-hmm. but to a power wheelchair. Simple power wheelchairs can be $15,000, $16,000, very simple power wheelchairs. More complex power wheelchairs or standing devices, not quite like ours, because there's nothing like ours in the market, can go up to $80,000, $90,000. They're very expensive. Our product is $30,000, and we actually will discount that down for cash purchase, but it's $30,000. And then if you add an outdoor kit and a warranty and a transfer seat, it can get up to around $40,000. So it's priced lower than anything else in the market that gives you the kind of freedom that this does. It's also the only device that fits in your home in normal spaces. And so, for example, workers' compensation will pay for it. It costs between $60,000 and $200,000 to retrofit your home if you need a wheelchair. Yeah. And for us, all you need is a ramp. You don't have to spend that anymore. You literally don't have to. The other thing this device lets you do, which no other device lets you do because of the unique design, the way the tail assembly is built and the way you get into it, is that if you have control over your bodily functions, you can use the bathroom yourself. And so back to mental health and back to dignity and back to the want to live a life of freedom on your own, if you can use the bathroom, normally if you have lower body paralysis, you need an aid to get you into a bathroom, because you have to transfer from a seat to be lifted to be put onto a toilet. And with our device, it just lowers you right onto it. And so now you're just free to do that on your own. And we all take that for granted. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that can be taken for granted by everybody.
Wow. Incredible. Will my paraplegic friend know about this? I mean, I'm going to send this to him. But, you know, do people know about this? Is the word out?
It's a great question. So I've been, you know, living with this business for 13 years on or off now, peripherally and now directly involved. And we just brought on about 45 independent sales reps around the country in the past 16 weeks. I've interviewed about 180 people in 16 weeks. It's been like speed dating. And what I can tell you is normally you'd be shattered. Your ego would be shattered when you meet with somebody and you say, well, what do you think? And they say, well, I've never seen this thing before. And that should crush your spirit because you've been at it for so long. But the truth of the matter is, it's the best news I could ever hear. Because now we've got people in almost every state in the U.S. selling, and it's a field green, right? People have not heard about it. And so it's getting the word out. It's marketing, et cetera. We are working with United Spinal. This is great. They are an amazing organization. They really walk the walk and talk the talk. Their CEO's in a wheelchair. A lot of folks who work there are members of the disabled community. And they have picked our device and their tech advisory team to help promote to their membership, 250,000 members in the U.S., because they recognize that small companies like us don't have budgets to market because we're spending our money innovating. The big companies don't innovate. They're managing the bottom lines.
Nothing. Sorry, I'm getting a little choked up here myself listening
we all
to this.
Do.
Yeah, thank you. Nothing is more inspiring than the stories that you're telling, particularly the surgeon who can now stand or the anesthesiologist who can now intubate. Stephen, do you have a personal favorite story where your device made the greatest impact in someone's life? I'm sure you have many. Do you have a favorite?
I don't. I don't. I would have to say my favorite story is the Bill Winchester story, only because the much maligned FDA worked so well with us. They were so helpful. They let us ship a device to Bill before we were approved by the FDA. And we had to give our word that it would stay boxed in his garage. And Bill and I have been friends since that day, and it's been many, many years. But really, every time, I've seen hundreds of people stand, and every time it happens, it's just, it's such an emotional experience.
Thank you.
MatiaMobility.com. It's MATIA, mobility.com. We are speaking with the CEO and chairman of the board at Matia Mobility, Stephen Bull. He's also a Park City resident, and he has 13 chickens. And four dogs. You know, no shortage of wonderful and interesting and fascinating people in this community, and you certainly are one of those. So, Stephen, it's great to meet you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both for having me here. It's been great.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW, Park City.